You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Well, welcome, everybody. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings, and delighted to welcome you to this event on Southern Sudan in Transition, Protecting and Promoting Human Rights. Sorry for the little delay in getting started. We were waiting for the representative from Southern Sudan, who was sitting on the front row as we prepared to greet him. Well, anyway. Since the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed in 2005, there's been a lot of excitement about Southern Sudan, about the possibilities for first an end to this terrible long war, and then the prospects of independence. As you all know, the referendum in January resulted in a resounding clamor for independent secession, which is to take place in July of this year. And while there's a lot of excitement, there are also a lot of daunting challenges in terms of poverty, oil, violence in Abyei, problems with political leadership within Southern Sudan. And to explore some of these issues, we've got a very distinguished panel to speak to you. We'll begin with a representative from Southern Sudan, Ezekiel Gatwath, who has been a member of the SPLA-SPLM since 1984. He studied in the United States. He's held a number of positions vis-a-vis the United States and will speak to us from the perspective of someone representing this soon-to-become independent country. He'll be followed by the ambassador from Kenya. Ambassador Odembo has been ambassador here since a year and a half, more or less?
July of last year.
Okay, 8 months. Therefore, very knowledgeable about things happening in Washington. He has a long history of involvement with civil society groups in Kenya, and certainly as a neighbor of Sudan has a lot to say about the situation happening next door. He'll be followed then by Joyce Leader. Joyce was a former ambassador to Guinea, long career in the State Department, and did some work with Brookings not too long ago in Juba, looking particularly at the work of the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission and possibility for them to monitor displacement. Finally, we'll hear from the always outspoken Andrew Natsios, former administrator of USAID and special envoy to Sudan, has worked with NGOs and government and military and has done just about everything and certainly always has something to say. We're very glad you're here, and we'll begin with you, Honorable, if you'd like to use the podium to make some remarks.
Would have been better if I can sit down because this is actually too short for me.
You may sit down if you prefer.
No, I can. Thank you very much. So happy to be here. And of course, when you are actually talking about Sudan, you cannot be late. I was here almost around 9:50. I will be briefed and quick so that we can maybe interact and answer some questions from the audience. The history of Sudan is actually a long history, but I will actually make it short because issues of Sudan are complex. Definitely you can talk for almost 3 days about Sudan. But basically, the history of Sudan, of course, we have been actually at war with each other for a long time before independence in 1956. Southern Sudanese actually fought the war of independence in 1955 because they wanted to actually be in their own state when the United Kingdom left. Of course, we end up being part of the North in 1956. But that war from 55 to 56 to 1972, that was a war of independence so that we can have our own independent state. Definitely another war broke out. We had a relative peace from 72 to 83. And then May 83, another war broke out again. This is the war myself and my colleagues here participated in. And that war was actually basically calling. It was spearheaded by late hero Dr. John Garang-Dama Mabiru. It was basically saying, let us transform Sudan, because the history of Sudan was basically a history of marginalization, discrimination, and exclusion of the marginalized areas. Southern Sudan is part of it, Nuba Mountain and Southern Blue Nile, and even Darfur. So that war ended in 2005, and we had an agreement called Comprehensive Peace Agreement. And in that agreement, it was meant to address two issues, basically. The rest are formalities. One is, let us transform Sudan into a better Sudan for all of us, the restructuring of Sudan, so that Sudan can belong to all of us. So I don't have to feel excluded, because when British left in 1956 or 55, Sudan was narrowly defined as an Islamic and Arab state, which is actually wrong, because 60% of the population of Sudan are Africans. So you cannot actually categorize Sudan as an Arab country. Yes, you can actually say the majority of Sudanese are Muslims, but there are other religions. All the religions in the world, they are in Sudan, including my own religion until 84 when I was baptized to be a Christian. The African small gods. The second one, if we fail to transform Sudan into a better Sudan for all of us, the second option is the referendum. Southern Sudanese decide their future, if they want to remain in the north or form their own independent state. Track one, we have failed miserably to transform Sudan into a better Sudan. So that's why we went to track two. A referendum, Southern Sudanese voted overwhelmingly, 99%. For the independence of the South. The referendum was very free, fair, and transparent. Even sometimes people are actually saying that it was actually very unique, because 99%, we always hear them in the election of Saddam Hussein and other people, but it happened in the 21st century. So it was actually credible, free, and fair, and transparent. Yes, there are challenges. Southern Sudan is going to be an independent state, comes July 9th, 2011. This country has been marginalized for years. There is no development at all, no roads, even agricultural resources that we are so good in, they are not yet developed. We are basically relying on oil, 98% of our budget from the south. Is basically from oil. So definitely there are a lot of challenges that we need to meet in July, or starting from now until July and beyond. Institutions are very weak, especially institutions that can actually deal with issues of human rights, the police. When we went in 2005 to govern Southern Sudan, there was no actual police. Institutions are not there. And then definitely we need help to make sure that the police force is built from a guerrilla soldiers into a professional police officer, so that they can actually deal with communities. Rule of law is something that we really need to be supported on, so that we can actually deal with the issue of human rights. Definitely, President Salva Kiir is somebody who is promoting the issue of, because we have been fighting for democracy and justice for all. So definitely we are advocate of preserving human rights. So in a nutshell, I just wanted to finally say that definitely we are going to be an independent state, but Northern Sudan and Southern Sudan will continue to be there as neighbors. So there are issues of post-referendum issues that we need to tackle. One of those is actually the issue of oil, because now the pipeline is going northward and the oil, 80% of it is in the south. So the north, they need us and we need the north so that we can cooperate on this issue of oil industries. And then definitely the issue of refineries. They are in the north and the oil is in the south. We really need one another. The issue of border, our citizens will be they will actually cross the border, because this border in Africa, it is actually not a border that is fenced. So you can actually walk from there to here. Like myself, I'm from a border between Ethiopia and Sudan. So there is nothing that actually you can see on the ground that is actually, this is the line where you can stop. So basically your cattle can cross and people also can cross. So definitely we need to actually agree on how we can actually manage this border. And many other issues, the issue of debts and assets, an issue of currency. These are the post-referendum issues that we will be dealing with before July 9th, 2011. But definitely as a young government, we need your help in making sure that our capacity is built and we can govern effectively. Because the most important thing that we are actually tackling now is the issue of governance so that we can govern effectively. Because most of the things that are happening in Africa is weak governance, you know, so that people are not happy with their government and they rise up against that government. So we wanted to make sure that we start with equal footing and we can actually build a viable state comes July 9th. I will stop here. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ambassador Obimbo.
Go a little lower. As you can see, we are from the same stock. good morning, everyone. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Special Envoy Ezekiel. It's a pleasure for me to be here to speak briefly about Southern Sudan, a country that I know a bit about, but not as much, obviously, as Excellency Ezekiel does. In between the years of 2007 and 2008, was in and out of Southern Sudan at least six or seven times in my capacity as a civil society and development and human rights activist at that time based in Nairobi. That is my background, as was mentioned earlier. And our agenda at that time really was to start working within the CPA arrangement. As Special Envoy Ezekiel has mentioned, the need to build civil society, because there was a very almost non-existent civil society. You had people who had been working, had been fighting in a civil war for many years, and therefore during this period of the CPA, some of us thought that it was very important that we engage with civil society organizations in Southern Sudan and help starting to build the capacity. And it was during that time that it was quite apparent to me, meeting and talking with many civil society leaders in Southern Sudan, that the referendum was going to come and that it was going to be fairly conclusive that most Southern Sudanese, as Special Envoy Ezekiel has mentioned, were not happy with the status quo. Economically, politically, and socially, yes, marginalization continued. People didn't feel that they were adequately represented. And for those of you who've been to Southern Sudan, you will appreciate that it lacks in the most basic of facilities and infrastructure, everything from education to healthcare and the big infrastructures such as roads, electricity, and so forth. Kenya as a neighbor, again, it is in Kenya that the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed. I was standing no more than 10 yards behind the late John Garang when he signed it at the Nyayo Stadium in Nairobi. We as Kenyans celebrated the signing of that Comprehensive Peace Agreement as if it was ours, but mostly because we had engaged very significantly with the North and the South. And we have tried all along to maintain an honest broker relationship with both Khartoum and Juba as well in the course of the period of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, because it is our belief that come July 10th, when the CPA actually ends, there will be a post-CPA period and program that we will need to embark on, and it is extremely critical that the relationship between Juba and Khartoum be one that is healthy, one that is facilitative, because, again, as the Special Envoy has mentioned, there are a number of fairly serious pending issues And I don't see the international community as having paid enough attention between the time of the referendum and July in addressing these. I know everybody is working in different ways, the UN, the United States, the European Union, the African Union. But I honestly do not see a comprehensive, robust program that recognizes the fact that between the referendum and July, we have some weighty issues that really needed to be tackled. So we will be waking up on the 10th of July, and we will still have a number of these issues still pending, but the situation will have changed because we will be then dealing with a situation where we have two countries. And if it was difficult negotiating these while we were under this arrangement of a semi-autonomous Southern Sudan and basically still under one government in Khartoum, I suggest that it is going to be even more challenging to now deal with these weighty issues beyond the Comprehensive Peace Agreement time. My feeling is that there are big economic issues that need to be sorted out because Southern Sudan is going to become independent. The referendum was 99.999. I mean, it could not have been more resounding. But the work begins. The reasons for which Southern Sudan has wanted to secede and to become an independent country are the issues that Excellency Ezekiel has outlined very well. Marginalization, exclusion. Once 10th of July arrives, those issues will still have to be dealt because there are issues within the South, and we have to make sure that there are no communities in the South who feel marginalized in this new arrangement, because it is not homogeneous. There are obviously common platforms that the people of Southern Sudan were able to agree on, and in their decision to secede from the North, that was very clear. But now there will be a new set and challenges, as the special envoy has mentioned, that the Southern Sudanese will have to deal with. Some of them are political and have to do with issues of human rights, issues of governance when Southern Sudan becomes independent, but then there are social issues. The lack of infrastructure in Southern Sudan is incredible. In my opinion, the post-CPA UN IGAD, Intergovernmental Authority on Development, arrangements really need to be the equivalent of a Marshall Plan of some kind. I think nothing less than a Marshall Plan for Southern Sudan will do. And the reason why I say this is because if we don't move with haste so that the people of Southern Sudan begin to feel that life is changing, that life is becoming better, that their basic needs of food, water, access to health care, and access to education are addressed quickly, then I think the challenges that have been mentioned will be even greater. Kenya stands by the people of Southern Sudan. Kenya looks forward to a continued engagement with Southern Sudan, Juba. We already have a very, very good relationship. I think we invited Southern Sudan to join the East African community before the referendum, and I think the indications from President Salva Kiir are that Southern Sudan will become a part of the East African community. The regional bloc of Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi, I think the inclusion of Southern Sudan will be part of how we can fast-track the economic development that needs to take place in Southern Sudan, lest people get disillusioned. I want to bring to your attention Kenya, of course, in terms of the civil service that needs to be developed. We have engaged and continue to engage and have made some serious commitments to the tune of $10 million in the next 3 years to work with Southern Sudanese civil society, to work with Southern Sudanese government, to build the civil service. We are starting from almost scratch to build the police, to build the military, and we will continue to engage with Southern Sudan because we know very well that a prosperous and developed Southern Sudan is in the good of the rest of the region. Congressman Christopher Murphy of Connecticut did a very good statement. So if you go to Congressman Murphy's website, you will see a statement that he has issued to Congress with regard to some of what he thinks needs to be done, and also highlighting the role that Kenya has played in southern Sudan and in the comprehensive peace agreement between North and South, and the very critical role that we look forward to playing as Kenya in southern Sudan. I thank you all very much. Thank you.
Mr. Ambassador, we turn now to Joyce Leader, and a bit of an obstacle course here.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased also to be here. As Beth said, I got to go to Southern Sudan, to Juba, to do some work for them with the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission. It was for only a week, and it was my first visit to the country of Sudan, although I've spent a lot of years in my career dealing with Africa, working and living in Africa. I had never been there before, so I do not claim to be an expert. But I would like to share with you today some of the first to let you know about the staggering magnitude of the internally displaced people's problem or issue there, and then to make just a few observations that grew out of my work with the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission and the interviews that the assessment team that I worked with from the organization had during the week that I was there. Well, there are really sort of two sets of internally displaced, and those would be those that are within Southern Sudan proper and the 10 states there, and the second would be those that are going to be returning from outside now that the country is gaining its independence. And then the first group, the largest group, is the victims of conflict. And basically these are people who have victims of communal violence, competition over scarce resources, particularly water and grazing. And food insecurity exacerbates these kinds of conflicts, as does drought. When the rains come, the conflict diminishes, and when the rains don't come, the conflict increases. Flooding, when the rains do come, becomes the other side, the flip side of that coin, and there's a lot of displacement with flooding. I should say the numbers of the victims of conflict last year were about 220,000. That's the neighborhood that we're talking about. That's about the same number that was displaced internally during the at the end of 2009. And they are predominantly in Jonglei State and Lake State, where the communal violence is pretty significant. But the other kind of violence is the local militias. And in particular, the LRA, which is, as many of you know, the Ugandan group that has taken refuge northeastern Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, and they have made lots of raids into the western part of southern Sudan, and 42,000 people were displaced last year as a result of that. And there were even more people who actually came as refugees from the Congo into southern Sudan. There's some development displacement from the oil. The oil wells have been built on land that belonged to people, many of whom fled during the fighting during the war. And there are some war displaced, a number that's not been really calculated, people who, instead of fleeing from the border areas, because that's where most of the displaced people have originated from, instead of fleeing north, some of them actually fled south, didn't cross a border, remained displaced within southern Sudan, actually displaced some further south who became refugees. So and these people are fairly well settled and have been for decades and don't really consider themselves displaced at this point. So then there are people who are going to be returning. Since 2005, of the 4 million who were displaced to the north during the years of war, 2 million have since returned. By October, 2 million had returned to the south. Staggering numbers, as I said. Since October, keeping pace with the previous return rate, 250,000 plus have returned to the South. And these are according to figures that IDMC, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center reports, and OSHA report these same kinds of numbers. This leaves about 1,700,000 in the North, mostly around Khartoum, and in and around Khartoum. The other kinds of returnees, of course, are those returning refugees. 500,000 fled across borders to neighboring countries. 400,000, UNHCR estimates, are likely to return during this year. And I should say, and I'll come right back to this, that the Southern Sudanese Relief and Rehabilitation Commission is expecting or planning for returning 1.3 million more from the north to the south during the course of this year. So a few observations. The government and the international community of IDP stakeholders I found to be totally focused on the return issue. And they were particularly seized with the process of return. The Southern Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission had a pre-referendum strategy of getting back as many people as possible, as quickly as possible, hopefully all, before the referendum. That was rescaled back a little bit to slow down the pace a bit, but it's still called an accelerated return plan, as I said, to bring back essentially all of those living in the north. And in some ways, that's and some of these are coming, but people are coming back spontaneously. Others are being assisted. They're trying to plan for transporting this many people back. And IOM, the International Organization for Migration, is their partner for the transport aspect. On paper, this is a very good, their plan looks very good, and it's totally consistent with the guiding principles. But I would say that there are a few questions that need to be asked. One is the voluntariness of it. When I posed that question to an official at the SSRRC, they said that they would be able to express where they wanted to go when they got to the reception centers inside southern Sudan. And I thought that might be a little bit late if they were people who wanted to stay in the north. But there is a problem. But in a way, things may have been overtaken by events, because the North has said that all of the Southerners should leave, and so they have the problem is that so now they're afraid, and so many are going, whether that's their first choice or not, expulsion and the possibility of losing citizenship if they stay in the North. Protection is another issue on these return journeys, which are quite long. They have been attacked. They have been stalled because for one reason or another, and the roads have been closed. So there's a lot of issues along the way that are something of have human rights implications and the protection of IDP implications. And, of course, reintegration itself, with this many people returning to places, as the representative said, where there's been no development, no roads, half the people do not have access to clean water. 1.4 million in the South are dependent on food assistance. Food insecurity is a very major problem throughout the South. So these kinds of pressures will need some watching, and in terms of potential for conflict, the potential for differences and all kinds of issues, and the pressure on services, as you can imagine, again, lack of schools, lack of clinics, lack of access to water. So in its planning, the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission has been part of the National Planning Task Force for IDP returnees, but I didn't get the impression that the staff in the organization itself were really seized of this matter, but I did discover part of the reason was that the attitude is that, well, IDPs, that the organization has a reluctance to take IDPs as a separate group of people, separate from all the others who are disadvantaged and who need services and who need support. And so they want to look at it more as a community, as a whole issue, a holistic community approach, which makes a lot of sense in these circumstances, but it also sometimes can overlook some of the issues and human rights concerns that are unique to persons who are displaced or who are trying to find their way back to their place of origin. And the mandate of this organization doesn't mention IDP specifically. It talks about the citizens and the population of the region. And I should mention also that the policy of the government is to have the people return to their place of origin. Now, some of them have been displaced for decades. They haven't been to that place of origin. They've developed a different sort of lifestyle from a rural lifestyle. They've been much more urbanized in the north during their time in the north. There are no livelihoods for them to come back to, but many still do not want to stay in those rural areas and are migrating to the towns and urban areas. So this is, again, putting new pressures on those areas as well. Now, back to SSHRC, they did talk about IDPs, internally displaced persons, in their 2008 annual report, which is the last one they've issued for budgetary reasons predominantly. They did talk about camp conditions being very difficult, and they also, interestingly, noted the challenges of IDPs who were returning to places of origin that were occupied by other people or oil wells or something of this nature, lands that they thought they had, but they were unable to return to. And and IDPs, I found, also are mentioned in the work plan goals and strategies. But now the organization has, hopefully in part as a result of our mission, named one of their staff persons, their human rights officers in the protection unit, to be a focal point for IDPs so they can begin to look a little bit more closely at the group that does have some special needs. UNHCR is the lead agency in protection agency for the internally displaced. They somewhat share this with the United Nations mission in Sudan, which had the full responsibility in a way for protection, but now is mostly focused on physical protection, while UNHCR has taken on the leadership of the protection cluster under the UN system of trying to support the IDPs. The protection cluster got off the ground in July. It's co-chaired with the Norwegian Refugee Council, which is the with the Norwegian, an NGO, and they've initiated a rapid protection needs assessment strategy. And this is an interagency, humanitarian organizations, UN organizations, NGOs, government agencies could probably be also involved, although I'm not absolutely sure. But they're working at the state level. And this is the government of Sudan, Southern Sudan, has the 10 states, and they've devolved a lot of the administration into the state levels. And this is where a lot of the action is going to take place. And so this rapid protection needs assessment has actually been called into service 10 times in the first 6 months of its existence, probably mostly for the communal response to communal violence or to the militia attacks that may have caused displacement. And, of course, UNHCR is looking into the reintegration, early reintegration issues as well. I would note that UNDP, that you might expect to be involved in many of these things, is not really doing that. They have focused all of their attention, as I understand it, in southern Sudan on building the capacity of these state administrative units, the ministries that are represented at the state level, and so forth. And they've actually offered funding to the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission to help on the IDP activities at that level. I would also note that there is a bit of a policy vacuum on the IDP issues. There was a 2009 national policy on IDPs that adhered very closely to the guidelines, the guiding principles on IDPs, but I was told that it was written under duress from the international community and never implemented. But there are so many issues that are likely to need policy guidelines. Although it's not seen by the Ministry of Legal Affairs and Constitutional Development as a priority now, given all of the other post-referendum priorities and independence priorities, but they have asked UNHCR to help develop a policy for durable solutions. So the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission will want to try to work on strengthening its IDP protection work through increasing networking with the other organizations that are already working on IDP issues and bringing to it this human rights and IDP rights aspect. It will also benefit from partnering with these other IDP stakeholders, and particularly in the states. And I found that there were some excellent opportunities for the Southern Sudan Human Rights Commission to do this. UNHCR invited them to become part of the rapid protection needs assessments when they took place in the various states. And they urged UNHCR to join them in helping to develop the policy on durable solutions. And they also encouraged them to become more involved in advocacy, to support and reinforce messages of the international community using their privileged position to carry these messages to government actors. UNDP, as I mentioned, did offer financing, and the Legislative Assembly has a committee on human rights and humanitarian affairs, and they've actually requested assistance with training legislators on IDP principles, because they are going to be engaged in monitoring returns and in advocacy work at the state levels, talking with governors about preparedness. So they wanted to be more knowledgeable about that, and I think that offers an opportunity that would also allow the senior levels of the Human Rights Commission to be more in tune with the guiding principles. So, and outreach is another activity that the Human Rights Commission is going to be engaged in now that they've been trained. Some of their people have been trained as trainers. So this is going to be another activity that they will be able to be engaged in as the returns issue becomes more front and center on their agenda, as it will be definitely on the agenda of the Southern Sudan government.
Thank you very much, Joyce.
And Andrew Nakius.
Southern Sudan is facing two major challenges, one external and a whole set of internal issues. And let me talk about the external problem it faces, and that is that the new northern Sudanese state, because it is not the case that one new state will be birthed on July 9th. Two new states will be birthed. The northern state will be profoundly different without the south in it. And everybody knows that in the north, and people know that in the south. President Bashir said December 20th that with the South leaving, they will now constitutionally impose in the Sudanese constitution a statement that the northern state is a Arab Islamist state that is sure to cause political unrest in the north. Why is that? At least 45%, by my calculations, of the northern Sudanese state after July 9th will still be African. and they do not want to be called Arabs, and they do not want an Arab state, because all that will do is cement in place the same kinds of issues that have existed since 1956. Secondly, there is a large body. There are still half a million Christians in the north, but there are also a large number of communist and socialist people on the left in the north who may be Muslim in their personal religious beliefs, but they are not in terms of their political views. They believe in a secular state, and they do not want Islamism in the Sudanese constitution. There's also a large body of Islam that comes out of the Sufist tradition, which are very ambivalent about the notion of an Islamic state in the north. So it is by no means, and in fact, Hassan al-Tarabi, who's sort of the bin Laden of the north and the leader of the radical Islamist movement since the 1960s, his party never got more than 18% of the vote in any of the national elections that were held, legitimate national elections that were held. And so by previous votes, we have evidence that this is a large minority, or not even a large, 18% is not a large minority. So Sudanese public opinion is very mixed on this subject, and any attempt to impose an Islamist Arab state in the north constitutionally and legally will force the organization of the Darfuri rebels, the Nuba Mountains, the Blue Nile constituencies led by Malik Agar, who was elected by governor by 56% of the vote in a legitimate election. He's a northern governor, and he was an SPLM commander. He's a Muslim, and he's a northerner, and he's an African. And he is a secularist in terms of his views in the state. He was elected legitimately against the party's, the NCP, the Bashir's party's candidate. And so we know in Blue Nile province that in a legitimate election that the great bulk of the people voted for against Bashir's own party. The Beja people were already in revolt in the Red Sea province. And in the north, northern part, the Nubian people are very upset with a whole bunch of issues. So there is unrest in the north now. If the north destabilizes, and I think there's a risk that it could because of the behavior of the regime, it will affect the south in several ways. One is there will be a northern SPLM party that will be a separate party, which will be an independent state, but they still have association with the south. Two, more importantly for the south, since, as Ezekiel said, a large portion, almost all of the oil, the revenues of the southern government, they have a large number of people in the public payroll, they have a large state structure at this point who rely on those oil revenues for their paycheck. If that stops because of chaos in the north, it will affect the south. The oil pipelines that could go through from the south through Ethiopia or Kenya will take 10 years to build. It can't be done overnight. And the oil pipelines now that go through two oil refineries in the north to Port Sudan could be effective if there is a civil conflict in the north, and there could be under these circumstances. And so I think stability is very important for both the north and the south. The Arab revolution going on in the Levant, in the northern Africa and the Levant, in the Arab world, is affecting the north in a very interesting way. And you can see the statements being made by President Bashir and other members of the NCP government in Khartoum. They see this as a victory for their Islamism. Now, the Islamist movement is divided in the north between those in the government, Bashir's party, and Hassan al-Tarabi. They had a personal split. They hate each other, but they are still Islamists, and their ideology is very much the same. They're a little bit more pragmatic in the government. Tarabi's still quite radical. But the fact is their ideology is the same, and they see the removal of the Mubarak regime in Egypt as a victory for their allies in the north, because they came out of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. That's where the whole Islamist movement started in Sudan, is in Egypt. And they now, there's statements in the north, they're beginning actually getting quite arrogant in the northern government and self-confident that they saw themselves surrounded by secularists before. They see them now surrounded potentially by their allies, the Islamists. They have had a long time, 20-year treaty with Iran. Iran has base rights in Port Sudan. This is a public treaty. It's not a secret. that any Iranian ship can land without any permits, without any approvals or anything else in Port Sudan. They have armaments factories, and they have advisors in the Sudanese, Northern Sudanese Army. So there's a very deep relationship. In fact, the closest ally of Iran in the world is the Sudanese government. Those relationships will be cemented, not diminished, after independence in of the South. So the North is still a serious issue even after July 9th. It's not going to go away. And depending on how the Northern government deals with these issues of secularism versus Islamism and Arabism versus a more inclusive state, will affect the stability of the North and therefore the South. Secondly, with respect to the South, there is a series of very, very important issues. These have been discussed, but let me just add a few comments. This is not a reconstruction effort in the South. It's a construction effort. One of the least developed areas in the world is southern Sudan. That was a policy of the British to keep the Arab slave traders in the North away from the South during the period of independence from the beginning of the 20th century until independence in 1956. But their policy was to keep everyone out from the North to protect the South. But it also meant the South wasn't, until very late, had no schools. The only schools in the South were missionary schools run by the Anglican Church and the Roman Catholic Church. The British did not build infrastructure in the South. And that was a major impediment to development, and that's what the South is attempting to do right now using oil revenues. And I think, actually, they've made remarkable progress in 5 years. I'm astonished at the international organizations and aid agencies and NGOs complaining about progress. They should have seen the progress the United States made the first 5 years in the Republic. I mean, we didn't have anything in this city. This city was a giant swamp for the first 10 years. It took a long time. I mean, the Southerners are actually far in advance from where we were in the United States in the mid part of the 1790s after our independence. So they're making progress. They have a huge problem in their hands, and that is they do not have an educated workforce. They have an 85% illiteracy rate. The United States had a very high literacy rate at its independence, and that was a major factor in our development in the 19th century, is the fact that we had an educated workforce and some pre-existing institutions. The remarkable thing about the South is it is not simply oil that they have in riches. They have water. In a huge water resources all over the South, not just the Nile River, but the Sud is the largest wetland in the entire world. There are 2 to 3 million animals and wild animal herds in the eastern part of east of the Nile River. It is the largest population of wild animal population left in Africa. It's larger than the Serengeti. Or some of the other game parks in the South. In fact, there are several species that we thought were virtually extinct, and there are 50 or 100,000 of these antelopes in the East. And they're beginning now to look at development of the tourist industry, tourism in the eastern part of the South. Secondly, they have huge mineral resources, among the richest mineral resources in Africa. They have luxuriant soils in a continent where, frankly, most of the soils in sub-Saharan Africa are very, very weak, are not strong. That is not the case in southern Sudan. They have 60 or 70 feet of rich, extremely rich black topsoil. So the chance for the possibility of large-scale farming in the South is very real. And there are discussions. Anne Ito, who's a PhD from Kansas State, and she's an entomologist. She's the Minister of Agriculture. She's educated in the United States. She knows all these issues. I just met with her a couple of years ago. She knows a couple of weeks ago. She knows exactly what needs to get done. She's highly educated. She's a very good manager and very tough, I might add. And she's going through all the things they need to do to begin to grow food on a large scale in the South, including inviting companies in or people in from other countries that are used to running large farms in a scientific way, which is a very wise thing, it seems to me, under these circumstances. The South is also very thinly populated compared to other countries. Kenya, Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi is the size of southern Sudan geographically. Those four countries have 92 million people in them. Southern Sudan has 8 or 9 million people. So there are large tracts of land that you don't have to do any displacement on. They're not they're not used right now. And so the South can develop plans without having to displace populations. Now, there, you know, there are conflicts, as Joyce has said, about who will settle where. Okay, but there's a large areas of land that could be developed in the South without a lot of political turmoil, which is very unusual in many of these countries. Very rich land, I might add. The biggest problem in the South will be in the development of functional institutions, public, private, nonprofit. And I want to say that we all know in development theory and development practice that the thing, in fact, there's a lot of literature in this at the World Bank, and Douglas North won the Nobel Prize for developing institutional economics. The principal reason wealthy northern countries are wealthy and stable and democratic is because of the density, the resilience, and the legitimacy of institutions. That is what distinguishes poor from rich countries. And the South has only two broad categories of functional institutions. One is the SPLA, because the war has been going on so long. I mean, commanders give orders and orders are carried out. The SPLA is a functional military. It's still a guerrilla army, and it's being gradually transformed. The Kenyan government's doing some very important work. I think the manuals being used in the southern training schools to train their NCOs and their officers are actually the Kenyan, because the South has decided on English as the lingua franca of the South. They're in English, and they've been changed over the years by the Kenyans in a way that's actually very compatible with the South. And so one of the things I did when I was envoy is the U.S. government paid for the mass reproduction of these manuals. The Kenyan army was very helpful in doing this, but they're being used in the South to transform the army into a conventional army under the control of civilians. Very important that they not interfere in politics in the South. The second functional institution, which is something people are nervous about in this city and in this country in dealing with, is the church. The fact is, from my estimates, the fastest conversion to Christianity of any country in modern history was Southern Sudan. And there are a variety of reasons for that that are beyond my comments today. But there is a reluctance in international organizations and bilateral aid agencies and some secular NGOs to deal with the church. And the church is not, like it is in the United States, sort of another institution. It is the institution. During the Civil War, the church provided the schools to the extent that there were schools. They were the social organizers of the community. They were the local government. They maintained some of the roads. And to the extent that they could get any health care in, it was the church that did that. And there is a reluctance of aid agencies and international to deal with church institutions in the South. I might add, the best way to make sure the Southern government deals with the human rights issues well is to train the pastors, the priests, the bishops, the archbishops in international human rights law. If I were to do something in the South, it would be with civil society and the civil society organization capable of getting the Southern government to pay attention to any issue is the church. There are a lot of very devout Christians in the government, but there is no reluctance by the Archbishop of the Catholic or the Anglican Church or the Pentecostal pastors to go in to see Salva Kiir or the government and say, you're not doing this right. We want this. The people want this. And they respond to it. They take the church very seriously. But it's an entirely independent force from the government. So if I had a recommendation to make to the international organization, they'd better put aside this Western mindset of the separation of church and state in the traditional Western sense of that. The Southerners don't want theology in their Southern Constitution. But they want us to reassess how we view religious institutions in both the North and the South. I mean, this is not just, it's also with the mosque and other areas of Africa, is how to deal with the grassroots religious institutions, which we don't do a good job of. What is it that we should do in the United States? Well, we still need a robust aid program. I think we have to reassess how it's working, because a lot of the focus is using traditional institution-building techniques that do not work in the South for a variety of reasons. The Northern policy during the Civil War was to destroy as much traditional organizational structure as they possibly could do. They persecuted the church. 4 million people died. And there is a demographer, Millard Burr. There are a lot of silly estimates, exaggerated estimates of the number of people who died in Darfur. That is not the case with this 4 million estimate. Millard Burr is a PhD in demography. He did a study for the U.S. Committee for Refugees and tracked how many people died in the war. 4 million people have died from 1956. Almost no other civil war in the world, other than Afghanistan, suffered casualties like that. The destruction to southern society was a policy of the northern government since 1956. It's not just Bashir. It's been done by every single government in the north since 1956. And it's had a profound effect in the south. And we need to recognize that. So we need an aid program that assesses where the south is developmentally, which it has not done. It's trying to transfer things that work in other countries to the south, and they don't work very well. We need a different approach. Two, I think we need to try, personally, if the South wants to do it, only if the South wants to do it, to tie the U.S. economy, as we have in many other countries where we have allies. We've done this in Morocco, in Jordan, in Chile, in Peru. We're about to do it in Colombia, in Central America, and we've done it with Ghana. I think we have a free trade agreement with Botswana. So there are a number of countries in the world that are allies of the United States that are stabilizing forces in unstable areas where we've signed free trade agreements to pull down all of the trade restrictions between our countries. And that will encourage American investment in the South, which I think would be very good for the South. Secondly, I think we should, as a government, sign a security guarantee, a formal treaty with the South after independence that protects the territorial integrity of the South. Now, that is after these issues have been settled as to where the border is. I'm not suggesting the United States get involved in that other than as a mediator. But I think that we need to do what we did with South Korea after the Korean War, is a security guarantee and a formal treaty, not station U.S. troops there, but an agreement as to how we will see any attack on the South. If the South remains stable, it will stabilize all of East Africa. The North-South War has destabilized the entire region for 50 years. Ask the Kenyans or the Ugandans or the Ethiopians. I mean, there were a lot of fears in Ethiopia and Kenya as to what was going to happen if the war started again. They're going to seal their borders because it's caused so much chaos in the neighborhood. Stabilizing the South is in the interest of all of East Africa. And it's, frankly, in the interest of the North as well. I think the North should know what U.S. intentions are. And the third thing is I think we need a large U.S. embassy in the South. Now, so I've had people here who see the United States as an imperial power who wants to that's not what I'm talking about. This is if the South wants it. Every Southerner I've talked to want a large U.S. diplomatic presence in the South. Why? It's an indication that we intend to stay there and have a presence. They want a U.S. presence. They want an alliance with the United States that's not based on this victimology thing where we see the whole South is a bunch of victims. That's how everybody perceives the South. The South is about to become an independent country. We should stop treating them like a victim. It's not healthy. It's also not accurate. They're a sovereign state. They're going to have an ambassador to the United Nations. They're going to have an ambassador to the United States and other powers. They are a sovereign state. We should treat them that way and stop thinking of them simply as a victim. Have they been a victim? Yes. But they're transitioning to a new position in international affairs and in African affairs. They're going to be a member of the African Union. And I think we should change our attitude as to how we see the South. Thank you.
Up here. And when the microphone comes your way, please introduce yourselves. And why don't we start back here? If you could stand up.
Hello. All the panelists mentioned.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Oh, I'm Shilpa Nadhan. I'm a second year master's student at Georgetown University. And all of you mentioned capacity building, and Professor Natsios mentioned that Southern Sudan has 85% illiteracy rate. How does one, especially in these crucial years, find enough civil servants that are educated to sort of bring the government to stability over time?
Lawrence Freeman from EIR Magazine African Desk. I was particularly interested in the ambassador from Kenya's remarks on a Marshall Plan. This is what I've also been discussing in my trips to Sudan, is that the entire country of Sudan needs to develop around water, power, and food. And in fact, the entire region, using Sudan's agricultural, using combined new water agreements from the south, from Ethiopia, this entire area can be developed to produce food, an abundance for Sudan, an abundance for the Horn of Africa, an abundance for the Maghreb. I don't see the West issuing this kind of, this is infrastructure development. This is power of energy, water development, rail development. So the question is how is this going to be done? And the Marshall Plan is the right example. I think the Western economies are collapsing. Europe, the euro may collapse this week or by Monday. So this poses a question of getting an economic system to provide this credit. And I think this is in the interest of the South and the North. And this is what I've tried to discuss with people. They have to get over some of the long-term prejudices. And I think the South has to recognize that continuing to blame everything on the North is a loser. There are real problems. And the unity of a common interest approach for Sudan and the entire Horn of Africa is in their interest. I think this is far better than free trade or depending on the market. But I would like your response.
Thank you. Perhaps the gentleman right behind.
My name is David Teslico from the Public International Law and Policy Group. Most of the recent media reports have dealt with allegations by the South of northern material support for rebel groups or other destabilizing forces, and I was wondering if the panel could comment on how large of a factor that will be in impeding negotiations both within during this transitional period and post-independence. Thank you.
Okay, let's take one more perhaps. Maybe someone on this side. This woman here.
Hi, Katie Corbin from Creative Associates. I'm also thinking about the education sector, and I'm wondering what role peace education will play in the ministry, especially considering that a good number of the teacher workforce will be ex-combatants.
Okay, thank you. We can turn to our panelists now. We have two questions on education, finding educated Sudanese to provide leadership roles and the role of peace education, the issue of a Marshall Plan, and the question of northern support for southern rebel forces. Perhaps you'd like to start?
Okay. Is this working?
It's working.
Okay. thank you very much. I think I will answer the issue of support by the National Congress Party to the militias in the south. Yes, we had a meeting this past Sunday on the 21st in the UN Security Council. It was the government of Southern Sudan calling or asking the UN Security Council to convene a meeting to investigate the support by the North to the militias. Yes, it is true. The documents are there. Not only documents, but material support like guns, uniforms, and all of this, they are there. And even those who were captured during the when we were fighting those militias, they testified, and they actually said basically, we got our guns from the north in Kosti and other places. The support is actually real, but what is actually the benefit of the north by doing this? This is the question that we are asking. I think there are two things to this. Of course, one, the North, they have tried to prevent the referendum not to take place by encouraging militias to destabilize the South. From the beginning, this is not a new strategy. It has been there during the war. But we thought that they are going to stop this. I think what they are trying to achieve is actually to disrupt the referendum, but this one was not possible because Southern Sudanese were united, South-South dialogue was there, the international community were united to making sure that the referendum is going to be held on the 9th of January 2011. So they were squeezed into this. They were pressured to accept the reality of the situation internationally and inside the country. But now the referendum is gone. Another way of actually reactivating this a strategy to destabilize the South is to have their own government that will be loyal to the North, basically. This is like the situation of Syria and Lebanon, you know, in the 70s and 80s. Basically, Syrians wanted to have their ally in Lebanon ruling this country. This is basically the strategy. Because they are telling, they have dismissed more than 22,000 Southern Sudanese from the Sudan army in the North and retraining them and then sending them to the South to go and take over the government. Telling them that, yes, the referendum is conducted, you are going to be an independent country, but you take it because you are our ally. This is actually a reality. It is happening. What are they going to get out of this? I don't think they will benefit out of this because, you know, they will not overthrow the SPLM. It is going to create bad relations between the North and the South, which we don't want. And it will actually even, because it's a tit for tat. If they are doing it, we are capable of doing it also. But this is not going to benefit us. And that's why we are telling them and the world that let us actually work together to make sure we end the war in Darfur and we have an agreement on the post-referendum issues, you know, on oil, debts and asset currency. So because we know that the North need us and we need the North. And this should be the thinking in the North. On issue of education, we have a large Southern Sudanese who are actually in diaspora. Especially here in the U.S., we have 150,000 Southern Sudanese who are staying in different places, like in Nebraska. We have over 10,000 Southern Sudanese who are staying in Omaha, Nebraska. I don't know why they are there, but they are there. So definitely, some of them went to school, like myself and David here and Enoch and many others who are actually in the room. So they can go back home and be assisted. To get home so that they can actually help with the development. I think that has to be, and Andrew, I'm sure he knows about this. The USAID was actually trying to initiate a program called South Sudanese Skills Transfer Program, transferring the skills of Southern Sudanese in the U.S. to Southern Sudan so that they can help. And they can be assisted by, you know, providing some incentives so that they can go there. Because they have responsibilities here in the U.S., if they are going there, then who is going to take care of their families and who is actually going to... You know, basically, you need some programs to help them. I think it was done also in Namibia after the war by the U.S. here. So I think the same thing should be done so that we can actually help those who are there in southern Sudan because the commitment is there, the determination is there, we want to build our country. But if we are lacking capacity... I'm sure you can actually help in building our capacity instead of actually saying, because some people are saying, especially in the North, they are going to be a failed state because they are a bunch of tribes and they don't know how to live together. It is the North that is actually fueling this. After independence, Southern Sudanese, they love each other. We never fought each other from the 50s and 60s. It is after the war when instability and ethnic exploitation came about, and then we had issues. So I think we have a large community who are educated, and Kenya, we have a huge number of Southern Sudanese there, and Uganda and Ethiopia, they're highly educated. But I think that has to be a program to actually get them home so that they can help us.
Thank you. Mr. Ambassador, would you like to comment on the question about the Marshall Plan?
Thank you very much. I'll touch on the issue of education again. I do agree with Excellency Ezekiel that there is, I think, what you would consider a critical mass of Southern Sudanese who are very well educated and very well trained. It's a question of what kind of a program and what kind of a structure do we put in place to enable them to get back and be accepted and enable them to become a part of now this new Sudan. And play their role in the development of the country. Education is critical. Again, whatever else we do, there must be, Southern Sudanese must be educated. Former head of USAID, Special Envoy Nancio, has said it very, very well, that in fact we have a situation where we must not only invest in education, we must not only invest in education, but we must see education as part and parcel of a program of building human capacity, enough people not only to fill the civil service, enough people to run the private sector, enough people to run the non-governmental and civil society sector. So that education will cut across everything that needs to happen in the Sudan, including
the reference that I made to a Marshall Plan. It will not be possible. It cannot be a Marshall Plan that is imposed by anybody from the outside or the international community in whatever shape, form, on the people of Southern Sudan. The Southern Sudanese must be a part and parcel of any strategy moving forward, and it needs to be a 20-25-year strategic plan, and it needs to be a comprehensive one. It cannot be piecemeal. And what I see beginning to emerge, even with the current efforts, the post-CPA, UN-IGAD arrangement, isn't long-term enough. It needs to be 25, 30 years. A lot of what needs to be done in Southern Sudan will take many, many years. And for that to happen, there needs to be a comprehensive, long-term strategic plan, and it must be developed with the people of Southern Sudan. We already have, Kenya has one of the oldest public service training programs. The Kenya Institute of Administration was set up in 1950. Within the continent, it is one of the oldest. We have one of the most sophisticated civil service, so to speak. We have had, in the last 6 years, a number of Kenyan civil servants going into Southern Sudan and working with the people of Southern Sudan. We have actually, in the last 1 year, established the Kenya Institute of Administration in Juba. In the last 6 months, we have had more than 20 Southern Sudanese trained in our Foreign Service Institute in Kenya as diplomats. This has all been happening in the last 1 year, in the last one and a half years. The Marshall Plan, it may be the wrong word because I think, again, Special Envoy, nice to say, the Marshall Plan might imply that you want to reconstruct. There is no reconstruction. We're beginning from a scratch. So the Marshall Plan might not be the right word here, but what I'm saying is it has to be a comprehensive, a robust, long-term program with all the resources. It cannot be the business as usual. In terms of financing, not the usual financing mechanisms of the World Bank and the IMF will do here. We need to think about new and innovative ways to provide financing to enable the building and the development of infrastructure in the Southern Sudan to happen. I think I'll leave it there.
Andrew or Joyce, would you like to?
Well, let me just make a comment about the Marshall Plan comparison because I've heard it many times before. It isn't appropriate. The Marshall Plan was a credit plan through European banks that existed for 300 years before the Second World War with a highly skilled, in fact, the best educated workforce in the world was in Europe. I mean, a lot of them had been killed and the infrastructure had been destroyed, but the institutional sophistication of Europe was among the most advanced in the entire world, even in some ways more advanced than the United States was. And what we did is pump capital into existing institutions. And that's what led to the Marshall Plan. We didn't go in and build any of the stuff ourselves. It was done through, I mean, there were construction companies all over Europe. We didn't have to train anybody in construction techniques in Europe, German engineers. Germany had a 60% literacy rate in the 18th century. Okay? In the 18th century. They had 100% literacy rate in the 20th century. They had a political system was extremely dysfunctional. It's not really comparable. And I do think that a long-term presence is absolutely essential. And my fear is, because of the short-term nature of our political system in the United States, we're going to do something for 2 years or 3 years, or we have this counter-bureaucracy in Washington that I've written about that demands metrics for, you know, how much progress we're making by the week or the month, quarterly reports with thousands of statistics. It is a waste of time. It is destructive. OMB should stop doing it. The IG should stop doing it. The Congress should stop demanding it because it's actually diverting the AID and its partner organizations from getting the work done. It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take 10 or 15 years. We should stop taking this short-term, metric-based, quantitative approach because that is not going to help develop Southern Sudan. That's outside AID's control. They've resisted it. We've resisted it for years, and it's just being rammed down the agency's throat by the counter-bureaucracy in Washington, which is another issue, but...
Is this microphone working?
Yes.
I'd just like to make an anecdotal comment on the education situation. The people that I met, the young people that I found when I was going around interviewing people and organizations and so forth, many of those who were in positions of mostly support staff kinds of things, or even the officers, were returned refugees who had been educated from refugee camps, who had been educated through university by programs that helped the refugees in Kenya, in Uganda, and they were the ones that were providing sort of the intellectual robustness of these organizations. At the UN, at UNMISS, I found these people. So there is a cadre there that can be built on. The thing, of course, is to make sure that they do come back and feel that pull to come back and help build the Southern Sudan. The other thing that I would add to the list of government, non-governmental, and civil society organizations that need to be part of this capacity building is the private sector. There's virtually no private sector that I was able to find that was run, certainly none that was run by Southern Sudanese. And for example, the car agency where I had to rent a car and a driver, Eritrean. The water trucks that I saw on the all around town, the garbage collection trucks, Eritrean. The hotel, the camp that I stayed in, run by the Indians. The man who ran the little store that I bought my water every afternoon when I came home hot and thirsty, Ethiopian. So there are these people around from the neighboring countries who are finding quite interesting, lucrative opportunities to make business in southern Sudan, but it's not the southern Sudanese, and they're not getting the jobs in these organizations either, from what I saw. So this is an area also that I think is very critical.
Let me just add something to this. The southern government took a decision 4 years ago to encourage East African entrepreneurs to come into the country. And they facilitated 100,000 East Africans, Ugandans, Kenyans, Eritreans, and Ethiopians, to come in, start businesses, work with them on a small scale, even a larger scale. Mm-hmm. And this was not an accident that it happened. It was a deliberate policy because they said, we've been at war for 55 years. We don't have skills developed here. We don't have institutions developed. So we imported people. I might add, the Gulf states did the same thing. I mean, 95% of the people in many of the Gulf states are not from those countries. They're from Sri Lanka or India or Pakistan or the Philippines or Bangladesh, and they were all imported because they had skill sets and a large number of laborers. In fact, there are a lot of Sudanese in those countries in the Gulf states. So the South took a deliberate decision to do this. It's not an accident. Mm-hmm. And they hope over time that there will be skills transfer just because some Sudanese are being hired in some of these institutions. So it is an issue, Joyce. You're absolutely right.
Well, my point is that it shouldn't be just hope. It has to be a deliberate policy of transferring this. Otherwise, it'll be domination by the people from the outside who did develop some attitudes about why they didn't want to hire Southern Sudanese.
So we're running out of time. Let me ask both of you to make a final comment, and then we'll need to wrap up.
Somebody did ask a very specific question about the education curriculum and the issue of peace. I did have an opportunity to look at the curriculum that is being developed for both primary and secondary schools, because the government of Southern Sudan has been working very closely with the Ministry of Education in Kenya, and there is actually a component of peace building incorporated in the curriculum. Again, I think in summary, it has been summarized very well that what we are looking at is a long-term strategy. It has to be comprehensive. It can't be piecemeal. It has to make sure that it incorporates and it is in partnership and in collaboration with the people of Southern Sudan. And it has to be across the board. It has to be in the public sector, in the private sector as well. It has to be deliberate. It can't be ad hoc, people coming in and doing their business, making their money quickly and running out. And it also has to be in civil society. And I agree that a big part of that civil society is actually a faith-based civil society and must be a part of this agenda. And we really do wish the people of Southern Sudan well. we will walk with them.
And the last word to Senator.
Thank you. Two things. One is actually our policy in the government of Southern Sudan. Anybody who is doing business in Southern Sudan, you have to have a local partner.
That's right.
And this is actually, those who are working there, they are teaming up with Southern Sudanese. This is a policy. Mm. Otherwise, you cannot be registered as a business person in Southern Sudan. Mm. That's our policy. And also to make them learn from those business people so that they can actually branch out or team up so that they can actually prosper. Final word is actually what Andrew said before. And thank you very much for your articulation about Northern Sudan. Unless there is a democratic transformation in Northern Sudan, you will never have peace in the entire region of Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to the panelists, and thanks to all of you.